Frederick is so distinguished that to call his service in the European Parliament the culmination of his career may open up a debate, but it was a very distinguished period of service. And we're going to hear about that now from Michael Welsh, one of his colleagues in the European Parliament.
The first directly elected European Parliament, with its 410 members, met in Strasbourg on July the 17th, 1979. It was an eclectic bunch of people, both in terms of politics. All shades of opinion, from the radical left to the neo-fascist right, were represented, and indeed in its composition. Nine former prime ministers sat down that day, with numerous other notables, but the majority were completely unknown in their own countries, many having failed to make the grade in national politics. The 61 British Conservatives, memorably described by the late Simon Hoggart as a wedge of public schoolboys pointed at the heart of Europe, were no exception. Among the young, the ambitious, and the obscure were a number who had already made their mark in public life. They included diplomats such as Sir Fred Warner, formerly ambassador to Japan, industrialists such as Basil de Ferranti and Sir David Nicholson, Sir Peter Van Eck, a former Lord Mayor of London, and Sir Henry Plumb, a much-admired president of the National Farmers' Union. Sir Fred Catherwood, who had had a successful career with Costains before becoming the first Director General of the National Economic Development Council, NEDI for short, and then chairman of the British Overseas Trade Board, fitted naturally into this company. He was a tall man with wispy hair and rounded spectacles. He invariably wore a somewhat battered tweed suit, brown or occasionally green, often with a cardigan underneath. When climatic conditions dictated, he sported an unfashionably short raincoat and a battered trilby hat. The overall effect was typical of the best kind of university don, or perhaps a country landowner who didn't want you to know quite how well he was doing. We soon discovered that this mild quirkiness camouflaged a razor-sharp intellect, boundless self-confidence, immense personal charm, and a moral compass that was set in granite. Fred was appointed to the chair of the Parliament's Committee for External Economic Relations, known as REX, a job he approached with the gusto of a man who understands his subject and knows what he wants. He quickly revealed himself as an outstanding negotiator. Had things turned out differently, he might have had a brilliant career at the United Nations. He taught me a lesson for which I am eternally grateful, that it is always best to work on the assumption that the person you are dealing with means well and desires the best possible outcome. And though they may be mistaken, their intentions are every bit as good as your own. His talents were quickly put to good use in his dealings with his senior vice chairman, the formidable, not to say Valkyrie-esque, Heidia Maria Vicarex-Zoyl, a German socialist of advanced views who had very little time for British conservatives. He won her over by taking her seriously, listening to her point of view, and doing whatever he could, reasonably could, to accommodate it. Somewhat to the amusement of his colleagues, the Fred and Heidi show became something of a feature, with the result that the committee worked harmoniously throughout his five-year term and established itself as a respected interlocutor and sounding board for the Commission's trade negotiators. Fred's greatest achievement lay outside the REX committee, when in 1982, spurred on by criticisms of eurosclerosis, he persuaded the President of the Parliament and his fellow chairman to establish a temporary committee on European economic recovery. At Fred's instigation, the committee commissioned a report by two leading economists, Professors Michel Albert and James Ball, which identified the failure of the EEC to permit commerce and industry to take advantage of the potential economies of scale foreseen in the founding treaties as being a major cause of Europe's lack of competitiveness. National regulations restricting free movement of goods, services, and capital were deemed to be costing each worker the equivalent of a week's wages every year. The Albert Ball conclusions were by no means universally popular, but Fred fought his corner, and as a result of his efforts, the Parliament in March 1984 adopted the principal recommendations of the report in a resolution that set out the building blocks of what became the single market. Following the European elections that year, I accompanied Fred to Paris, where he presented the resolution and its conclusions to the special advisor to the incoming Commission President, Jacques Delors. And a year later, the single market programme was launched by Commissioner Arthur Cofield. Today, the single market is hailed as Europe's greatest achievement. Its genesis was due in no small measure to Fred Catherwood's original vision and tenacity. His negotiating technique was simple. First, he used rational arguments, always trying to see the other person's point of view. If that didn't work, he tried charm and persuasion. And if that failed, he fell back on sheer persistence. Those who tried to obstruct Fred, and there were some, might well have empathised with the unjust judge in chapter 18 of St. Luke's Gospel. Fred simply never gave up. He twice stood for the leadership of the Conservative group, but his background as director of NEDI at a time of the Wilson government was a bridge too far for a party that was being led by Margaret Thatcher in her pomp. He swallowed his disappointment with a good grace and served two terms as deputy leader and later as a member of the bureau. He was totally loyal to the leadership and invariably a source of calm common sense in occasionally febrile group discussions. Fred was a European rather than an Atlanticist, but this did not prevent him from playing a leading role in the European Parliament's delegation to the US Congress, with twice yearly meetings in America and different European capitals. Occasionally heated discussion did not prevent him, and particularly Elizabeth, from forming lasting friendships with their American opposite numbers. In his final term, he served as Vice President of the Parliament from 1989 to 92, playing an active part in its administration and winning friends all round the chamber for his grasp of procedure and considerate, even-handed chairman of plenary sessions. And then he went on to serve as Vice Chairman of the Committee for Foreign Relations and Security. Fred Catherwood was not really a politician. He was a dedicated and gifted public servant. But he did not just serve the public. He served his country. He served his continent and his province. He served his constituents, his colleagues, his friends. He served his church. He served his family. And above all, he served his God. If an epitaph is needed for this gifted, devoted and profoundly Christian man, it is surely to be found in those words we've already heard once today in St. Matthew 25. Well done, thou good and faithful servant, enter thou into the joy of thy Lord.